and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast with me, Ian Welsh. We've got a bumper podcast for you this week. Coming up is the usual news digest and detail of some of what we're up to at Innovation Forum this spring. Plus, we've got highlights of one of our most popular webinar discussions from 2018, when I was joined by experts from Walmart, Coca-Cola and the Ethical Trading Initiative to discuss how business can identify and tackle point of recruitment modern slavery risks. And I recently met with Econometrica's Sarah Middlemiss, and we talked about the potential for satellite-based data for companies strategically analysing environmental risks. Next, though, is our regular review of what's happening in business and sustainability. Plastic and how to use less of it remains top of the agenda for many. Swiss conglomerate Nestlé has announced it will drop plastic straws from its products from February, and is also developing biodegradable alternatives to plastic bottles as part of a drive to cut plastic use and to make all packaging recyclable or reusable by 2025. Nestlé is the world's largest packaged food company. Nestlé Waters will increase the recycled PET content of its bottles to 35% globally by 2025, with US and some European brands up to 50% recycled content. The company says it is also working on other non-plastic alternative materials, assessing impact on shelf life and product costs, among other considerations. Announced last week was a new $1.5 billion fund that will fight plastic waste over the next 5 years, focusing in Southeast Asia. The Alliance to End Plastic Waste's 30 members include some of the world's largest plastic producers, including Shell, ExxonMobil, Dow and Procter & Gamble. The fund will be invested in waste collection and recycling projects. Many Southeast Asian cities lack capacity and sometimes even basic waste management infrastructure, and the Alliance will assist the Renew Oceans program to stop plastic entering the oceans via the notorious 10 rivers that carry the majority of land-based waste, including the Yangtze in China and the Ganges that flows through India and Bangladesh. The Alliance is coordinated by the World Business Council for Sustainable Development via its office in Singapore. While broadly welcoming the initiative, campaigners have argued that focus on scaling back the source of the problem, single-use plastics, is more important than developing waste management and recycling infrastructure. New research, just published by The Lancet, has added to the growing clamour around the future of food and how we can feed a growing population sustainably. A new report titled Food in the Anthropocene argues that current human diets threaten human health and the environment. It will not come as an enormous surprise, then, that the report calls for a decrease in consumption of meat, sugar and refined grains, coinciding with an increase in consumption of vegetables, fruit, legumes and nuts. These moves are argued to increase the chances of achieving the Sustainable Development Goals while providing major health benefits. Bad news, then, if you're hoping that dry January alone would do the trick. Last week on the podcast, we highlighted some criticism of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, and its boss, Larry Fink, for lack of action to follow up his call last year for companies to act more responsibly. Fink's letter to CEOs this year goes even further, arguing that profits and purpose are inextricably linked and that businesses have a responsibility to the communities they serve. Fink calls on companies to lead better in a divided world, particularly because governments are not sufficiently solving the world's problems. He points to frustration at stagnant wages and uncertainty about the future as fueling popular anger and nationalism, itself leading to political dysfunction. Addressing corporate leaders directly, Fink concludes, "At a time of great political and economic disruption, your leadership is indispensable." Fine words, and hopefully stirring the sort of action required. BlackRock itself can, of course, be sure that its own voting record in the upcoming AGM season will be scrutinised more than ever. Elsewhere this week, the French National Assembly has voted to remove palm oil's designation as a biofuel, meaning that it will no longer be eligible for tax breaks from 1st of January 2020. This was a defeat for the French government, which wants palm oil to retain its privileged status to protect, Greenpeace alleges, the interests of French oil giant Total, that currently processes 300,000 tonnes of palm oil every year at a refinery in southern France. The move from the National Assembly in Paris coincides with public consultation on the European Commission's proposed roadmap on deforestation, which calls out soy, palm oil, beef, cocoa and coffee as being responsible for 80% of tropical deforestation and noting the significance of European markets for end products in driving this. It's unclear how the roadmap process will play out, with forest campaigners keen for robust rules to be brought in, while Brussels seems to favour cooperation to develop more sustainable supply chains. Reforms to the EU's energy laws announced in 2018 have already meant the use of palm oil as a fuel will disappear across the bloc by 2030 in any case. How much consumers really care about where the products they use come from has long been hotly debated. Innovation Forum, we often agonise over how to include the consumer session in our commodity supply chain related conferences. So the uptake of some new consumer traceability technology might give an answer to the question of whether consumers are that engaged or not. OpenSC is a website that uses blockchain technology, naturally, so users can scan a product QR code and reveal full supply chain details. Developed by WWF and partners BCG Digital Ventures, the technology will initially focus on fish and beef, with plans to expand into other commodities, including palm oil and timber. The product's designers see it as a way of rewarding producers who farm or work at sea using best sustainable practice, and relies on increasing consumer demand for products that are guaranteed free of the likes of deforestation or forced labour. Some fisheries are already involved, and fish tracked by OpenSC were due to be served to world leaders in Davos attending this week's Economic Forum. Such technology might have spared the blushes of the Spice Girls this week, following the allegations that t-shirts branded hashtag I want to be a Spice Girl and sold for comic relief to fund gender empowerment projects were in fact made by Bangladeshi women on very low wages in factories where they were forced into long hours and subject to abuse. Embarrassment all round, naturally, denials from suppliers and promises of investigation. But more than anything, this is a reminder for apparel brands of the sort of publicity that they really, really don't want. Innovation Forum's winter webinar series will kick off with analysis of what's next for data and how to use it to develop actionable intelligence. We'll be joined by experts from SupplyShift, Verisk Maplecroft and Gilead Science on Wednesday 30th of January at 3 p.m. UK time or 10 a.m. New York. Sign up for free via the links on the Innovation Forum website or in this week's newsletter. We've also got webinars on emissions in agriculture, the potential for apparel supply chain circularity, and modern slavery risks coming up in the next few weeks. And Innovation Forum's spring conference season is on the horizon. Book this Friday, 25th of January, to save $400 on conference passes for our Business and Modern Slavery event in New York on 30th of April and 1st of May. Joining us will be experts from Google, PepsiCo, AT&T, Coca-Cola, Barrick Gold, General Electric, Intel and many more. Interview time now. Coming up, we've got highlights from our Point of Recruitment Forced Labour Risks webinar. First though, I recently caught up with Sarah Middlemiss, Space Programme Manager at Ecometrica. Sarah, why don't you give us a bit of introduction as to what Ecometrica does?
We are what we call a downstream space company. So that means that we take the information and data that comes from satellites and try and extract useful insights. So we're very much a data-driven company providing services to a range of customers, both corporate and government, normally around sustainability and environmental risk management. So as well as using satellite data, we also bring in other types of geospatial data to help companies and public bodies assess, manage, and report on environmental related risks and opportunities as well.
And what are the sort of trends that you're seeing then in the information that your companies are asking you to provide?
There are sort of three big things. So it's around compliance, looking at where there are certain regulations in place. So a big one in supply chains, for example, in Brazil, there's the forest code. So are we sourcing from farms that are compliant with that code? That are they restoring a certain amount of forest? And we're sort of developing the algorithms to extract the information from satellite data, as well as combining it with their farm data already. Equally, I think it's being used a lot more strategically. So trying to identify, well, where should I be sourcing from? Are there certain areas that yield has been increasing, that climate factors are having an impact on how certain crops are being grown and the amount that's able to be grown? And also, I guess due diligence is another trend, an important factor. So again, looking through your supply chain and understanding, well, what sort of impact am I having by sourcing soy from this particular area? But also from an investment perspective as well, if I'm investing in this, is there something lurking that I should be aware of that we might be able to find out from using satellite or other types of geospatial data?
I mean, it certainly came out at the event a few weeks ago. Companies want to engage with data and do it better. But I think equally, it came out that many companies are a little bit lost as to how to engage. So how are you seeing companies engaging with the benefits of better data provision and analysis?
I mean, I think I would agree with that slightly lost statement. I think our experience that it so far has been reasonably slow. I think a lot of companies have maybe an old school approach to it. So preferring to commission kind of one-off bits of consultancy or pilot projects, and governments are just as bad. But I think things are changing. There's more of a shift to identifying it as an operational cost. So information almost as a productive factor. I think a lot of businesses and public bodies have cut levels of middle management and those more technical positions such as GIS and mapping departments. So what they sort of want and what they need are sort of easy to interpret insights that produce actionable information. So they don't necessarily want the raw data itself that gets lost on most people, especially those people making the decisions at quite a high level. What they require is the insights and the actual information brought out of that data in easy to read reports and tables, interfaces, you know, something that's easily digestible.
Fine. So I mean, you're certainly seeing then that companies wanting, on the one hand, more sophisticated data processed, but on the other hand, that boiled down into easily digestible bits of information.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of managers or decision makers aren't necessarily interested in the technical details of NDVI indexes or the algorithms behind detecting where the forest is converted into agriculture. What they're interested in understanding is, my supply chain at risk? Are we compliant with this specific regulation around deforestation, for example, or this particular certification that we're trying to achieve? And then I guess also the information that informs a decision or an action around that. So if I'm not compliant, what is the action that is required? And then how can I check what kind of impact that has had?
Are we seeing then a move from companies from wanting data and insights for retrospective reporting then towards developing business opportunities? Where's that balance now?
Starting to get there, certainly. A lot of it is still around risk, but I think particularly as climate change is having an impact, certainly on how certain crops and supply chains are grown, for example. So what we're seeing is some customers are interested in understanding, well, where's the best area to source a certain crop? Barley for beer, for example. Do I need to try and source from a different area because the temperatures are rising? I mean, I guess a classic example would be the English sparkling wine industry. The reason that's taken off is because the weather has had an effect to make the English climate better for growing that particular grape. So there will be similar crops where that happens. And I think companies are very interested to get ahead of the curve. That's something that actually I think came out of the conference, as well as just looking at the various of regulatory risks. How do we manage those longer term climate risks and gain insights that will help mitigate against those?
What supply chains are you seeing your customers being more interested in now? I mean, what are the supply chains that are coming up that people want greater information about?
All the biggies, the ones supported by the TFA 2020. So soy and palm oil are a huge one. We do a lot of work in Brazil and in Southeast Asia. Cocoa is also very, very big as part of a project that I manage, the Forest 2020 project. We work in Ghana, and part of what we do is support the Forestry Commission to produce better data to identify where shade-grown cocoa is actually being grown, so that companies are able to identify whether they're sourcing from cocoa that's being grown illegally in protected areas or if they're actually fine. But I think there are a lot of other cash crops that are growing in importance. So coffee is one, and avocados as well. There's been stories in the news recently about actually cafes stopping serving avocados on toast because of the impact that's having on the environment and the implications with certain potential drug cartels in Mexico. And it's something that the both governments and companies in Mexico are incredibly interested in understanding, well, is this a risk? Can we certify to say that our avocados are being sustainably sourced and feed to the generation of millennials desperate for their avocado on toast?
That's certainly something that people won't have considered before, I'm sure. Let's think a little bit more about your Forest 2020 project. I mean, this is obviously it's a very large project you got involved in. It's the UK government funded, but it's working in West Africa, as you said. So what's it all about, and what are the benefits that's accruing from it?
The whole purpose behind it at the very sort of basic level is to try and improve national forest monitoring through the use of Earth observation. So like you say, we work across six countries globally, Latin America, Africa and Southeast Asia. And it's trying to improve how satellite data is used in some very technical terms. So how do we best detect where change is happening in forests? So there are particular challenges around cloud cover, where illegal logging means it's quite fragmented and difficult to pick up. Cocoa, again, very difficult to extract that information purely from satellite data because a lot of it's grown under the canopy. So what techniques and new types of data can we use to address those challenges? Another big aspect is around risk and opportunity mapping. So understanding which forest is most at risk of being lost, either from anthropogenic drivers like conversion to agriculture or also natural risks like fire. And also understanding which areas are most suitable for restoration. So ecologically, all of the countries we work in have made huge commitments as part of the Bonn Challenge to restore millions of hectares of forest. So the question is, how do we identify those areas that are most suitable for restoration so that those efforts and those resources are most sort of efficiently managed and allocated to those areas? Similarly with risk, there's no point in putting loads of money towards conservation projects in an area where the forest is already lost or in forest that's very well protected and actually at quite a low risk of being lost in the first place. And then the third sort of general theme is around digital infrastructure. So as part of the project, we are improving the data that's being created. Generally, there's just a lot more data around with the European Copernicus Programme. There's loads and loads of free data available. So how do we make sure that it's actually managed and disseminated and communicated appropriately? And that's sort of where Ecometrica comes in with our platform. It's providing that digital infrastructure to enable governments, NGOs and private sector to actually access and disseminate and interrogate that data in a sort of accessible and manageable way.
So in terms of future then, is that where we're going to go? Just there's going to be more and more free data available, and it's a question of how we're all analysing it and thinking through its implications.
I think a big challenge going forward is definitely not what data is available, it's how to manage how much is available. But I think even with commercially provided data, the cost of that is coming down. The more satellites that go up, the more that the cost goes down in the data. So, and there's also increasing interest in other types of geospatial data, for example, using UAVs and airborne surveys to gather much higher resolution or optical imagery or LiDAR imagery. So working out also how to combine that so that you're getting the most from the data, but also at the best price point for the customer, I think will definitely be an increasing trend going forward.
Well, thank you very much. There's obviously a lot of exciting stuff happening in the space information area. Sarah from Ecometrica, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, here are some highlights from one of our most popular webinar discussions from 2018, when I was joined by the Ethical Trade Initiative's Cindy Berman, Coca-Cola's Brent Wilton, and Walmart's Doug Nystrom to discuss how to tackle forced labour at the point of recruitment. We join Cindy as she outlines what the employer pays principle is all about.
The employer pays principle is very simple. Many workers that find themselves in a situation of modern slavery have been found to pay recruitment fees. So the employer pays principle simply states that no worker should pay for their job and that the cost of their recruitment shouldn't be borne by the worker but should be paid by the employer. Where workers have paid recruitment fees, that these need to be reimbursed to the worker as part of their right to remedy, because many of these workers end up in a situation of debt bondage, having made the decision often to migrate for jobs. They are charged by a number of recruitment agents that operate either in their local village or in a particular sector and charge exorbitant fees. Many of the employers that are recruiting migrant workers are also paying for recruitment. And there are a number of middlemen, as it were, that are reaping the benefits of this that end up making vulnerable workers even more vulnerable because they are indebted as a result of this fee. Many of them end up paying back the recruitment fee for the first 9, 12, or even 18 months of their job. So before they're actually earning an income, they are simply repaying this recruitment fee and getting themselves out of debt. The Ethical Trading Initiative, a lot of our members are recognizing this as an important risk to them in relation to their modern slavery obligations. The UK Modern Slavery Act requires that companies produce a modern slavery statement, but the UK is not alone. There are many other legislative requirements now on transparency and due diligence that are prompting companies to think very hard about the workers that they have in their supply chain, even fairly deep down their supply chain, and to consider what they need to do. And a number of our corporate members have signed up to the Leadership Group on Responsible Recruitment. Many of them have spearheaded efforts at the Consumer Goods Forum. We are heavily engaged in the Sustainable Development Goal 8.7 with the ILO and other international forums to try to address this as a collaborative effort. It does involve quite a lot of collaboration, as well as really understanding what the issues are in each context and ensuring that we're not simply taking a face value approach to this issue and trying to understand what were the drivers and the mechanisms and how to address what is an endemic risk in many supply chains.
Thank you, Cindy. Brent, turning to you, perhaps you could outline how point of recruitment human rights risks have impacted Coca-Cola and what the employer pays principle means for your business in particular.
Yeah, thanks, Ian, and thanks to the Innovation Forum for including me in this panel. I think Cindy has started off this discussion setting a very clear framework within which we're all trying to address this vexing issue around human trafficking, modern slavery. For us, we've been dealing with this space for a number of years, and initially we engaged around the issue of retention of passports. That was the first big tranche of work that we did back in about 2011. And then, of course, with changes here in the US around federal contracting with Obama's Executive Order 13627 and then federal acquisition regulations coming into play in 2015, it meant that we had to get ahead of the issue. And one of those issues was the payment of fees, because of course, as Cindy said, this is often the catalyst by which people then get trapped into a lifetime of misery and debt bondage. So we moved very quickly around 2012 to do some survey work within some of our markets where we knew that there were corridors of migrant labor. And this was for us particularly in the Gulf. So we went out and did a survey with a third party just to see what the instances were in terms of the legal environment. And of course, what we found was that in many of those countries and in other countries today, local law actually allows for the charging of fees. So you've got an immediate challenge when you're dealing with suppliers, particularly local suppliers in those markets, who believe that they are legally entitled to do what they are doing. And I think Cindy's point about cooperation and engaging with governments to get them to start changing the way in which they regulate their migration policy is very, very important to help companies operate in a better environment where the charging of fees is outlawed. And I think we're seeing a trend towards that, but it's incredibly slow. And so as a company, we decided to take a principled approach with regards to these issues. And we put them together with regards to both non-payment of recruitment fees, and that includes transportation fees, bringing people to or from a country. We also included making sure that contracts of employment were presented in a clear and truthful manner, and that copies of those contracts that people signed are kept and available for inspection. We also do the requirement that people have access to their identity documents. And we require our bottling system and also our suppliers to have in place management systems which ensure that those obligations are met on an ongoing basis. We also, of course, undertake a third-party auditing of our business in order to ensure that these issues are addressed. But it's not perfect everywhere. There are still challenges in those countries that do allow for fees to be charged, particularly within our suppliers. But we're doing a lot of work on a collaborative basis with other brands such as Walmart, in order to get out amongst the community of suppliers to the world's transnational businesses, to understand that this desire to move away from the model whereby people pay for a job is something that not just the Coca-Cola company or Walmart or Mars or one individual company expects, but all of us expect. And that if a supplier wants to enter into the global supply chain of any of these large brands, then they need to position themselves to make sure that they are not charging fees for people working in their business.
Thank you, Brent. Doug, I'd like to turn to you now. Put the same questions I put to Brent to you. So perhaps you can outline how point of recruitment human rights risks have impacted Walmart and what the employer pays principle means for your business.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks as well to the Innovation Forum for putting this on and inviting me to be part of it. And you've laid out all the points so far. Just to help everybody understand the Walmart context, if you don't already, we're large, largest private employer in the world. Largest company by revenues with 500 billion, 2.3 million associates. We're in 28 countries, 11,700 and something stores. That's 54% of our stores are outside the U.S. So given that context, you would think, well, you could just do it yourself. But I want to just come back to the point that's already been made and say that in this area, especially, collaboration is critical. This cannot be done by any one company. There are too many complexities to the way workers are recruited. There's too many government issues. There's different suppliers. There's different sectors. And so as a company like Walmart, who crosses electronics, apparel, food and beverage sectors, we can kind of be a convener or be kind of a bridge to different sectors and kind of bring them into this tent, so to speak. On our journey, similar to what Brent was saying, we've decided a couple of years ago that the way to combat forced labor was through the recruitment of migrant workers, through the employer pays principle. And so we joined the Leadership Group for Responsible Recruitment. We're also part of the Consumer Goods Forum that's already been mentioned as well. I sit on the steering committee for the Responsible Labor Initiative, which comes out of the electronics industry, but is broader than that. It's open to non-electronics as well. And they're doing some good work in this area. On the government side, we're part of the Bali Process Government and Business Forum, where we're interacting with the governments in the region of South Southeast Asia to discuss human trafficking, forced labor, and we're putting recruitment of workers as a key part of that agenda. And that just the second meeting just took place in August in Bali, Indonesia. So there's a collaborative piece where it's absolutely critical to the success of this. Individually, we've added it to our standards. We've embedded the recruitment of workers and the payment of fees by the employer into our supplier standards. We are focusing as a member of the leadership group on Malaysia and Thailand. And so within those two countries, we're working with the International Organization for Migration to map out our supply chain and then dig into where the labor is coming from in those two countries, and then do some training of the employers and of the workers, and then even of the labor brokers. We're working with the ITSRA Institute through our foundation. We funded them, and they ended up creating an app for workers from Myanmar to Thailand so that they can rate labor brokers and kind of share their experiences, so that kind of like Yelp, you can kind of find who's a good labor broker, who's not. We're also doing some other data things with them, some responsible recruitment work of employers so that they're trained. Some of our supply chain is going through a program that the Responsible Labor Initiative is also putting on, called the Responsible Workplace Program, where employers, workers are being surveyed, and employers and workers are having training to try to move them to a place where they understand how this should operate and to become more satisfied in their work as well. You know, it's part of audits. We have third-party audits. We have different audit schemes that are approved. You know, that's sort of the first line. How do you find it? Hopefully we can find it in audits, you know, and we're working with these audit schemes like SMETA, SEDEX, like BSCI, ICTI, RAP, the Responsible Business Alliance audit. And we're trying to get them to come together and actually do a job of finding the fees, finding the problems in a better way. We have training portal for our suppliers, and we've embedded responsible recruitment training into that so that suppliers have access to that. We have in our department close to 200 associates around the world, and a lot of those are actually engaging with suppliers. And so they follow up, they will visit facilities, they work with our sourcing teams and try to find this. We also have an investigation team that if allegations do come up, they can go in and actually verify those and find out if they're true or not. But all that to say, this is just come back to the point, it's a complex problem. Simple solution is that the employer should pay, but getting to that point is going to take a huge effort in collaboration. I believe in that, you know, we've got to come with one voice across sectors, across suppliers, across retailers, across brands like Coca-Cola, and have that same voice so that it doesn't be like whack-a-mole. If it pops up in our supply chain and we get it and then it moves over to somebody else's, they have the same voice and the same requirements.
Sure. Well, thank you very much.
For more insight and debate on what companies must do in modern slavery, don't forget to register this week for best price passes for the conference in New York on 30th of April and 1st of May. And don't forget to join our free webinar on Wednesday, 30th of January. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.